Today on the Monocle Weekly Edition 97, we'll be asking what the current crisis in Syria means for neighboring countries in the region.
Syria has the potential to unleash or unlock so many different, potentially contradictory movements across the Middle East.
That was Nicholas Noe, political analyst and editor-in-chief of MideastWire.com. And our Raw Bound, we'll be catching up with Katie Lang about her new album, Sing It Loud.
A lot of these takes were live off the floor, including the vocals, so the immediacy of the creativity is captured. And it's really about walking into a setup that's very conducive to capturing great moments.
And later in the program, we'll be talking to Dr. Michio Kaku about his new book, Physics of the Future, that predicts the scientific breakthroughs that will change our lives over the next 100 years.
There are absolutely staggering advances being made in medicine, complements of the computer age, complements of DNA sequencing, which are going to change the way we view our organs, change the way we view our lifespan, and change the way we view cancer.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly.
Hello, happy May Day. It's Sunday, May 1st, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with Andrew Tuck and Steve Bloomfield. Your pins must be quite sore, Andrew, from being up on that scaffolding all day Friday doing the royal wedding coverage.
Well, you know, my little legs, it's quite hard to clamber up there as well. So yeah, that's why I'm a bit tiring. But yeah, it was a lockdown London day. The whole kind of city was kind of, you know, enthralled by a royal wedding.
And Steve, and you were sort of chasing the time zones as well, because you did the coverage from Ottawa and I think you flew on to Wellington and then you were in Canberra just sort of testing the mood across the Commonwealth. It was quite something.
Well, you know, on an occasion as big as this, you need to, you know, you need to bring out the big guns and send them all over the world.
So, yeah, all two of you.
Yeah, so, yeah, and it was an amazing kind of piece of branding. For, you know, it's an interesting exercise in, you know, what royalty means, what Britain means, and just kind of the number of press here from around the world. It's
well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, they talked about whether there was going to be sort of, you know, a spike or a dip in terms of what this meant for the GDP. But, I mean, if you just look at some of the numbers, as you're saying, that I think the U.S. networks alone combined, I think, sort of sent, you know, 1,000 correspondents, producers, researchers over to cover this. And, you know, they weren't all probably staying in 100-pound night hotel rooms either.
No, and it's funny because I think lots of people were very cynical in advance that, in fact, you know, the royal family has lost kind of credibility around the world, and actually not that many people would be interested. But I see
you've still got bunting stitched on the back of your jacket, don't you?
The word bunting, maybe, yeah. That's my nickname.
Bunty-tuck.
It is now.
Okay. Which is extraordinary. You know, that even this day and age, we get so caught up in those events. And it was interesting walking around London. I walked down Regent Street, you know, a week ago, and they had up kind of, you know, Union Jacks strung across the street. It looked, you know, it could have been Edward VII being kind of getting married or something. It became a proper old fashioned kind of piece of kind of British pomp and pomposity.
Pomposity. Yeah, you would have thought actually that there would have been a national propaganda machine that was handing out flags and bunting as well.
Well, indeed. And I think, you know, even as a Republican like myself, it was, you know, it's quite an event. Yeah, and it's quite cool to watch, just to sort of see, you know, what's going to happen. I think even if you don't believe that, you know, there necessarily should be a king or queen, you know, to actually watch it is quite special.
And you had a bit of tittle-tattle as well, because one of your friends was involved in some of the dressmaking, weren't they?
Yeah, I know somebody who made three dresses for three different people attending the wedding. And he was telling me that one of his clients was, one, insistent on having a white dress, and two, insistent on having a white dress that was kind of cut down her back so far that it kind of reached the crack of her bottom. And when he pointed out that it would be better to have another colour, she was very insistent that she was going to wear white just like the bride.
Right.
Wow. This wasn't actually the bride, was it?
No. Right. This is some very, very competitive people who are kind of attending.
Mm. Talk about diplomatic incidents. You didn't cause any diplomatic incidents when you were in Ankara.
No.
Almost,
no.
Though.
I was well behaved.
Well,
we
sent you off to Ankara to do a piece, not just on the foreign minister, but just, well, I guess Turkey flexing its muscles in general.
Indeed. And it was fascinating, aside from being in Ankara itself, which is not the most exciting of cities. And pretty much every diplomat that I spoke to, and I said, so, you know, how do you like Ankara? They're like, it's a bit boring.
Well, they could have asked the same question because, you know, I was in Canada over Easter weekend. And, I really have to feel for diplomats who are based in Ottawa as well, because there could be a face-off between Ankara and Ottawa, maybe Canberra too.
Well, it's a question we've come back to a few times, is why you can't create a kind of an administrative city that's kind of fun to be in. Even Brasilia, which is amazing to look at, it's not Rio.
No.
And I think all those places that people are just, you feel sorry for them because they're all kind of there thinking, oh God, you know, what time can I get the Friday flight back to Rio or back to Sao Paulo? Or, you know.
Well, I have a question about, I'm not sure how much street life you encountered in Ankara, but I noticed, I was in Ottawa for about 24 hours and it was fine. I had enough time for family, Easter and everything. And I went to one or two coffee places, went to buy some magazines, etc. And I noticed that most of the girls and the boys actually, all over Ottawa, they look like characters out of Stieg Larsson novels. I mean, most of them actually look like the girl with the dragon tattoo or kicked the hornet's nest or played with fire. It's quite frightening.
I didn't notice that in Ankara.
No, okay.
Although the one thing I did notice there was that the weather was terrible. And having come from...
Not great in Ottawa either.
...an unseasonably hot London and think, oh, I'm going to Turkey, it would be great. And landing in a very sort of dreary, grey and rainy Ankara, it was... I feel like I got the short end of the straw.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but you grabbed for that flight, though, because you originally thought, oh, well, you know, maybe they might move the meeting to Istanbul. Didn't happen, did it?
he was hoping, first of all, to catch him on the road somewhere, quite glamorous. And then,
exactly.
No, you're coming to Ankara.
We thought, well, maybe we could do a thing where we follow you around for 2 or 3 days. And
yeah. It's kind of the Birmingham of Turkey, isn't it, Steve?
That was uncalled for.
while you're at the foreign ministry, though, you got a bit of time at a very sort of late hour with the foreign minister. But I'm wondering, I guess you'd been planning on 3 days, but I'd say that they're quite busy watching events south of the border right now.
They are very, very busy, and it was interesting. Sort of, you know, watch them for. Yeah, for a day or so, they had he had meetings with the Romanian foreign minister. Then he had meetings with the Latvian foreign minister. He had 2 meetings with the president that day. He had another meeting with the prime minister at a recent NATO summit in Brussels. He was telling me they'd been there for 36 hours. They had 12 bilateral meetings with other foreign ministers, and a further 9 were planned, and they couldn't fit them in. And that just shows you, I think, how important Turkey has become, you know, particularly right now with everything that's going on in an area which is essentially their backyard.
I mean, how busy are the embassies? We'll come to Damascus in a moment, but of course, you know, Beirut, Jerusalem, and elsewhere.
They're incredibly busy, and I think what's interesting is how you're seeing a bit of a shift in terms of power and focus. You know, and I'm sure we'll come on to this when we talk about Syria later, but there's only so much that, say, you know, Washington, London, Paris can do about these situations. If you want to sort something out in Syria, then Turkey are the guys, they're the ones that have, you know, most clout. They're the ones that have most influence, you know, both in terms of trade and also just in terms of, you know, they have a good relationship and they've been going back and forth between Ankara and Damascus, you know, many times over the past few years.
Mm. I mean, you would say, you know, even more than... In this case, potentially Tehran. Of course, you just did your piece on, you know, the role of an Al Jazeera as certainly as an instrument of foreign policy as well. So even more so than a Doha, you would say.
I think it depends on the situation. It depends on the country. I mean, I think, you know, both Qatar and Turkey are very influential in the Middle East and North Africa at the moment, and for different reasons. I think Qatar certainly has the money to back things up to help with peace deals. Turkey perhaps has the more mature diplomatic service and the better diplomatic service, and perhaps also better links with the West. But I think, you know, the two of them together, you know, in many of these cases, are far more influential than Britain, than France, than the US.
Mm. Do you think there's that awareness in Ankara? Andrew, you've certainly met a number of people on the foreign ministry side in Ankara as well. Or is it, you know, it's a bit of a debutante's ball right now, and there's they're really sort of spinning their sort of way around the region and seeing what works, or do they know that there is a real sense of clout?
I think they're beginning to realise there's a sense of clout, and I think that it's clout they've developed themselves by kind of bypassing kind of Paris and London and making their own networks of alliances in the region. And it's interesting that, you know, that I think that people want to have a voice in that part of the world that they can go to. So it's the same thing that we saw happening in Brazil, actually, whether, you know, whatever the US or Europe or Venezuela thinks of Brazil, they kind of go to Brasilia because they know actually it's a kind of a voice that will be moderate between all those regions and all those countries and play it reasonably straight. And that's the same with Turkey. People want to go to Turkey because, you know, even the UK or Tehran, it's a kind of moderate voice that can, you know, kind of play off all the sides.
One more thing to add on this. You know, there's been a lot of talk about how Turkey wants to join the European Union and, well, will the European Union let them? And France and Germany both have their reasons for why not. The way Turkey see it now is that, you know, they will join the European Union at one day. The question is it right now when Turkey is asking them to, or will it be in 10 years' time when Paris and Berlin are asking Turkey if they can join?
Mm, absolutely. Well, for a little bit more on the region, and certainly Syria in particular, Nicholas No is a political analyst and editor-in-chief of MideastWire.com. We met him last year while The Weekly was in Lebanon, and he joins us now on the line from Beirut. Hello, Nicholas.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Nicholas, I wanted to start by just the coverage. And of course, you know, Syria has always been incredibly closed. It's very difficult for journalists to function there unless they're doing a puff travel piece. But even now, when you think that the government forces, the security forces will be, you know, quite concerned with, you know, just keeping a lid on uprisings, and maybe they wouldn't be so concerned with potentially journalists slipping through the borders, it's remarkable to see, you know, how little is still getting out.
Yeah, I mean, it is remarkable. But one thing you have to keep in mind is that there's been pretty wide open media coverage in some of these other countries, which was a bit unexpected, and which was indeed uncharacteristic of many of these countries, especially countries like Libya, even Egypt, which is relatively open borders, unlike Syria, but their media is pretty state-controlled, or was pretty state-controlled also. So partially it's just relative to how quickly and how open things got over these last few months that Syria seems much more effective in being closed. That said, I mean, you know, the level of state control and repression in Syria has always been to several degrees higher than in most of the other neighboring Arab states. So, you know, yeah, the lack of coverage, especially given the evident violence relative to the violence that's happening, that seems almost on par with what's happening certainly in Yemen, but almost now with what's happening in Libya, it is a bit of a shock. And it's also a problem because it means that in this environment, a lot of innuendo, a lot of false information, etc., can get out there, which is creating further problems.
I guess from a Western perspective, there's you know, a level of surprise because, you know, we haven't seen a lot from, you know, from journalists who are German or French or from the US or the UK. But I'm wondering, you know, amongst Arab media and certainly from the perspective of MideastWire.com, you know, what is the source at the moment? You know, would you say, you know, is it an Al Arabiya? Is it Al Jazeera? I mean, who has sort of the best handle on things from traditional news sources at the moment, or is everyone literally shut out?
Well, I know. I mean, and this is actually, I don't necessarily know if the sort of best way to get at this is in terms of the quality of the reporting, but there is a major change undergoing right now in the Arab media and in Arab politics, indeed in the region. And you're seeing it most prominently in what's happening in Syria. And mainly the issue is Al Jazeera has always been derided as sort of, especially in the West, as being the sort of pro-resistance or, you know, at worst, pro-terrorist sort of news channel out of Qatar, and that it was very quick to sort of mob Mubarak out on both its Arabic and its English channels. What's happening in Syria is that Al Jazeera is also now at the forefront of the sort of reporting, the leaked video, the social media reporting, etc., in Arabic, also in English. Unlike what it's doing in Bahrain, neighboring state, where it's virtually, the coverage is virtually nil in both Arabic and in English. Now, this is a fascinating development because what some analysts are saying is that the rapprochement between the Saudis, and you'll remember that the Saudis own Al Arabiya, and it's typically been very hostile to Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, Syria, and some of those states. There's been a rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and between the state of Qatar, and that's having a very important effect on the kind of coverage, especially in Arabic, that we're seeing related to Syria. The Syrian regime has been surprised and is enormously angry at Al Jazeera right now. They regard the coverage of the events, whether they're right or wrong, you know, is a separate matter, but they basically regard Al Jazeera's coverage as a huge stab in the back. And indeed, they're intimating that it's a Saudi-U.S.-Israeli conspiracy to bring down the Syrian regime. That's a big change from these last few years, where supposedly Al Jazeera was battling against the Saudi-owned Al Arabiya, and they would provide sort of competing negative coverage on each other and each other's allies. So we're seeing a broad realignment. It's working its way through the Arabic media. And it might not necessarily be good, actually, for the trend of democracy and sort of real democracy in this part of the world, especially if you have the trillionaire state of the princely state of Qatar with Jazeera lined up with the trillionaire, you know, kingdom of Saudi Arabia, both kind of coordinating their strategies at an Arabic media level. That could be disastrous.
Nicholas, it's Andrew, who's also in the studio here with Tyler. I wanted to ask you a slightly different question, which is where you're sitting, obviously, in Beirut, in Lebanon. There's often been a kind of animosity towards Damascus, towards Syria, obviously because there was an occupation by Syrian troops for many years. People must, in one hand, think it's a good sense of schadenfreude seeing a kind of Assad getting a kick up the backside. But on the other side, there's a lot of talk that actually if the regime falls in Damascus, if things do collapse, actually this could all spill over into Lebanon and actually be a worse problem for Lebanon than having kind of Assad sitting next door. What's your kind of view on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's fascinating to see how this is starting to play out here in Lebanon. Just simply, indeed, as you said, especially the history of these last few years. One thing to remember about Lebanon is that the country is pretty split about its relations to Syria going forward, especially now that Syrian troops left after several decades of occupation, left in 2005. There is a pretty deep divide amongst different communities, including within the Christian community here, about how Lebanon should approach or ally with or be sort of opposed to Syria. What's interesting is that that divide is actually, I would argue, becoming sort of less of a factor as both sides sort of come to grips with what's happening right across the border, which virtually no one had predicted. I mean, Syria was supposedly the most stable, you know, quasi-police state in the Middle East, and Lebanon was the one that was, you know, always experiencing these convulsions. I think what's happening now is you're seeing on both sides of the political divide here a sort of pragmatic retrenchment and a sort of rethinking in some ways about how this next phase could play out. And indeed, I think that's why you're not seeing a sort of public piling on effect by, for example, the anti-Syrian crowd here. And on the other side, interestingly, you're not seeing a sort of vigorous media assault by Syria's allies here, especially Hezbollah, on, for example, the unrest in Syria as being an Israeli-American conspiracy. They've been very muted about that. So I think that's an indication that the Lebanese on both sides are trying to play this very safe, if nothing else, because the stakes are so incredibly high for this tiny country that's basically surrounded on all sides on land by Syria and then by Israel, which it's in a technical state of war with. I think both sides are seeing the need to be sort of pragmatic in this next stage and try and guard against some of that instability that could at some point try to spill over the border.
Nicholas, hello, this is Steve in the studio. In terms of the future of the Assad regime, do you get the sense that the government there is united, or do you think there are cracks emerging?
I think the first thing to say is that any analyst that tries to tell you what's happening within this regime shouldn't really be listened to. So, I mean, this is perhaps an even harder regime to read than the Saudi regime, the Saudi family. It's enormously difficult to say. I think the general statement is true that as the violence escalates, there's a likelihood of splits within the regime, which do exist, which are undoubtedly mapped upon sectarian divisions, especially between Sunnis and Alawis. The Alawis are the sect of the ruling Assad family, that these divisions will grow and that will become an increasing problem for the Assad regime in terms of dealing with these unfolding events. But beyond saying that, I think it's mainly guesswork as to what is going on within the ruling circles. And then the last thing to say is just there are multiple conflicting, sometimes concentric, sometimes overlapping circles of power and interests and influence. And this is certainly true in Syria, which has developed a Byzantine, you know, very dizzying array of these sorts of interest circles and power circles. I think just by virtue of that fact, the contradictions will start to grow at a faster clip as the violence begins to grow as well. Where exactly those cleavages are going to show through to the surface, when exactly, I think that's really up in the air.
Nicholas, just before we go, obviously so much has happened across the region since the start of the new year, but would you argue, though, that you mentioned sort of the intersecting circles and just the sheer diversity of Syria. Does it really make it the biggest house of cards?
The reason why I think a lot of folks are starting to talk about Syria as being the sort of the major seminal event in this few months of Middle East uprisings is twofold. One is a simple just balance of power thing, which actually hasn't gotten a lot of play in the Western media, I think, which is quite strange. But put simply, Syria has WMD capabilities, along with missile Scud technology that can cover a whole heck of a lot of the Eastern Mediterranean, including U.S. allies like Israel. This is something that is pretty widely acknowledged, that they have chemical weapons. Indeed, the Israelis claimed, or at least it's reported, the Israelis took out a nascent nuclear facility in 2007. So that just alone, I mean, if you think about Libya, who gave up, supposedly, it's all of its WMDs, that just right there limits the options, as has been talked about now in the U.S. in these last few days, although it's not usually said why, and this was curiously left out by David Sanger in the New York Times just the other day. The second aspect is that Syria is at the front line of this great conflict between the resistance axis states and what could be called the settlement axis states. Roughly, the resistance axis being Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas, and some other actors. And on the other side, you're talking about Israel, the U.S., and some of the major Sunni regimes. Of course, the Egyptians now are sort of, we're not sure where they are, and that's changed the calculus. If Syria goes through major changes, and again, most of the scenarios that people are talking about, I think, are not particularly good for stability or for democracy, much less for peacemaking in the Middle East between Syria and Israel, because Syria, of course, has occupied territory in the Golan Heights for some four decades. All of that means that Syria has the potential to unleash or unlock so many different, potentially contradictory sort of movements across the Middle East, unlike in a place like Tunisia, pretty far away from this major confrontation, unlike a place even in Yemen, where you're talking about al-Qaeda and limited terrorist threats, but you're not talking about big game changers, like, for example, you know, a huge Islamist, Sunni, extremist militancy that could grow out of Syria. You're not talking about WMD capabilities that could either revert to a more radical regime or be dispersed, possibly. And you're not talking about the frontline states around Israel that include actors like Hezbollah here in Lebanon and others that could really set off sort of a far larger series of conflicts and events than anywhere else.
Nicholas Noe, editor-in-chief of MediaSquire.com. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Andrew, just going back to our starting point when we kicked off, we can look at traditional media outlets, we can look at social media, and Steve, jump in if you want as well, but also, let's say, less traditional, maybe more traditional channels, certainly for getting the story out, which is foreign intelligence as well. And, you know, just to both of you, we of course have seen, you know, the shots earlier in the week of, you know, shot on somebody's mobile phone of, you know, kids throwing rocks at rickety old Russian tanks, etc. But are you surprised that there's not more getting out there? And I sort of turn to sort of, let's say, the less traditional channels that, you know, that other agencies are not able to get images out.
Yeah, it's interesting that I think, you know, especially in Daraa, that they found that they were dependent, you know, on mobile technology. So that's why they swiftly cut off the electricity, because they literally knew that people had to recharge their phones every 24 hours. So if you turn off the electricity, people can't recharge their phones. And if they're kind of using them kind of randomly and too often, then actually their footage stops after 12 hours. So I think the governments in these regions have really begun to realize how they can control the social media and the internet and why they need to lock those things down. But, you know, undoubtedly there are going to be spooks on the ground there, and it is strange that they're not getting better at getting out more footage.
I mean, do you think that's cost cuts, Steve?
Well, I think it is, and you've got cost cuts in two areas. You know, one is obviously, as you say, with spooks with diplomats. It'd be interesting to see what intelligence reports are coming back from embassies in Damascus. you know, if WikiLeaks can get them, or someone can. But interesting as well for journalism as well, cost cuts. It's a lot easier for a government to stop people coming into a country than it is to throw people out. Mm. And I think, you know, if you look at the number of foreign journalists there were in Damascus in the first place when all this started, you know, it was very low. And if we'd had more correspondents there, then the global coverage would now be a bit better.
Yeah, I think also there's, it's, you know, I'm surprised because, you know, maybe you rewind sort of, you know, 10 years ago. Well, you know, we've even had, let's say, the likes of the BBC sort of, you know, John Simpson sort of, you know, slipping into places. But, you know, to do that properly, it's, you know, I think, you know, many might think, well, it's just, it's the cameraman and it's the correspondent going in. But there is the fixers and the drivers, and it's, and particularly in Syria, it would be, you know, quite complicated.
And it's interesting how we've got so used to seeing amazing imagery. You know, when you look back at, you know, the even the invasion of, you know, Iraq and the attacks on Baghdad, that, you know, it was kind of, you know, entertainment almost. You were there as the kind of bombs went off and it was, you know, massive coverage. But even something like Tripoli, because the authorities there have been very strict in their access, actually you haven't seen really that much that's going on in the west of the country. You know, you've seen lots from Misrata, you've seen, you know, lots from Benghazi. But in the west, it's actually being locked down as well. So it's funny that, and I think then the TV stations get a bit bored if they don't have a good footage. And they go and look at other stories and it gets diminished down the schedule. And that's, I think, what's happened with Libya, for example. Often there just hasn't been good footage. You know, so the story, while important, hasn't played that well on TV.
Well, it's also about how it plays on both sides as well, because, you know, certainly if you go and even look at, you know, we were doing a story and going to Japan where, you know, U.S. Pacific Command, you know, was very happy to have a sort of fly into the opening of Sendai Airport. I mean, they couldn't have been more accommodating. You know, we didn't end up going down that route. But, you know, if the U.S., you know, war PR machine wants to work, they certainly can. But because of just, you know, all of the reasons as to why this is, you know, not particularly popular, we're not seeing, you know, a lot of stand-ups from Air Force bases in Sicily.
Well, and interestingly, if you look at the coverage on Libya, I think one of the reasons why there has been so much comparatively is that, you know, after the first couple of weeks, the Libyan regime realized that, you know, it might be beneficial for them if some Western journalists were in Tripoli. And I think that, you know, the whole thing is somewhat backfired for them. But it's enabled, you know, networks to do live stand-ups from Tripoli, to in fact anchor whole live shows from Tripoli.
Yes.
While all this has been going on. Whereas obviously in Syria, there's, you know, absolutely no reason why, at the moment anyway, Assad would feel that he would benefit in any way from having more coverage.
The only thing is, in Tripoli, even then, they're standing on a roundabout. You know, you're not taken to Gaddafi's compound after the bombing. You know, they're stuck on a roundabout with traffic going past in the background, and they're trying to surmise things out of a car window.
Mm. True.
And interesting, I think what Nicholas was saying was just, I think, you know, really the face off, but also, I mean, again, you know, to your recent visit to Doha. I mean, you know, where Al Jazeera sits in all of this too.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Al Jazeera is, you know, as we've said before, and as we've explored in the current issue, it's incredibly powerful when it chooses which side it wants to be on. Mm. And I think it's interesting that, you know, as Nicholas was saying, Al Arabiya seems to have taken the same stance as Al Jazeera, and that's the crucial thing. That if your protests have the support, have the backing of Al Arabiya and in particular Al Jazeera, then you're in a far better position.
Mm. Gentlemen, time for a bit of culture after this. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're in London. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. Well, he may not be with us here in studio today, but we still thought you'd like to hear from our Rob Bound. Earlier in the week, he caught up with Katie Lang to hear all about her new album, Sing It Loud. And here he is. And she is.
I'm with Katie Lang, who's in London, promoting and touring the new record.
Promoting. Touring at the end of May.
Okay. And it's Katie Lang and the Sis Boom Bang. The record's called Sing It Loud. Sis Boom Bang sounds like a good name for a band. This is your backing band.
Yeah.
Are they your co-writing? Are they your cohorts as well?
Yep, cohorts. Yeah, co-producer, co-writers. We recorded 8 songs in 3 days at one of my co-producer's studio in Nashville. So it was very comfortable. And, you know, the second we all sort of gathered and walked into the recording studio for the sessions, it was just palpable and it was immediate. And it was a spontaneous combustion, really. And we just were able to capture it.
Engines roaring.
Yeah.
And how does that work for you? Do you always go into the studio with like pre-planned ideas exactly as you're going to play them out? How does that work?
No, well, when you're doing original music, you don't really know. You just hope that you've got the right people together. But this time, it just was, you know, I've been in the business for almost 30 years, and I can tell you that something was magic about this particular group of people. And they're actually the people who are touring with me, too. So it's going to be a very easy and fun year.
And Sing It Loud is the name of the record. Is that something that kind of is that something that came to you afterwards after hearing the sessions back and thinking, you know what we should call this? You know what it sounds like?
Well, it's actually a song on the album, and it's kind of an anthem for the unique. So it just seemed to be sort of the summation of the experience. Yes, what you suggested. It feels very full of confidence and pride. Yeah.
And Nashville, I guess obviously there were country roots right at the beginning of your career, and we've kind of come full circle. We're back there now.
Yeah.
What's that like as a place to record in? There's so much history.
Well, it's funny because the beginning of my career was about Nashville. This time around, it was about my co-producer, Joe Passapia, who, like I said, owns a studio in Nashville. It didn't really have anything to do with Nashville in itself. But Nashville's actually really changed a lot. It used to be extraordinarily conservative. It's not so bad anymore. There's a very strong pocket of alternative musicians. Ben Folds and Jack White and people like that, Gillian Welch and people like that live there. And it's just teeming with musicians.
And Austin is obviously a well-known, you know, South by Southwest. Yeah. It's a well-known music city, an alternative city in Texas. Yeah. Most of us, maybe in the UK as well, think of Texas as being as conservative maybe as Nashville is.
Yeah.
Are they the kind of two main musical outposts in that state?
They are, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're both.
And is there a strange sort of sense of history in recording in some of these studios in a place that's so famous for
music? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, for example, the gear that you can rent. You know, there's one particular microphone in Nashville that, I don't know, it costs an extraordinary amount today, but it's the golden microphone and everyone has used it. And we didn't end up using it, but
it sounds like there's a superstition there as well.
There is, yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, it's steeped in, like you said, it's steeped in history and all sorts of ghosts everywhere.
A lot of your songs have had a yearning quality, or people sometimes associate that. And the new record seems it's got some slower numbers on it, but it seems, as we talked about, the name of the record, "Sing It Loud," it seems kind of like a joyful experience. How do you keep the lungs in order? I mean, the voice is so strong still after, as you say, 30 years in the industry. Are there tricks of the trade, or do you just wake up every morning and they're there?
I think I've kind of carved out a lifestyle that is kind of protective of my voice. I drink lots of water. I try to sleep as much as possible. I eat lots of fruits and vegetables. I don't smoke. I keep my drinking to a moderate amount. I never sing anything that hurts my voice. I try to avoid singing in circumstances that make me use it the wrong way. So I just kind of protect it, I would say.
Because a lot of people listen to your records and there sounds like there's Gauloises smoke and kind of a lot of coffee, you know, going on in there, or maybe some whiskey as well. It seems like such a rich voice. You as a singer probably hate me saying that because it sounds exactly like the opposite of what you should do, I suppose.
No, I love that. It sounds like that. It's great.
Chanteur's kind of idea to it. I guess it's the idea of a torch song, isn't
yeah,
it? That
yeah.
It sounds, it's got that smoky quality to it. Just going back to Nashville, is there anything you pick up from recording? I mean, I guess it's the first time you recorded with these musicians. Is it a happenstance? What happens in the studio? I mean, you know, as we talked about planning out a record, but is there a number of different takes that you take?
Well, I mean, it can be any number of ways, but on this session, it was about capturing the creative flow. A lot of these takes were live off the floor, including the vocals. So it's the immediacy of the creativity is captured. And it's really about the setup, you know, walking into a setup that's very conducive to capturing great moments and not having to fuss with the sounds. We just had everything set up constantly. So if everyone plays every instrument. So if we made a switch or we decided to use piano instead of organ, it was just immediate. It wasn't this big, you know, 2 or 3 hour resetting of microphones. And that makes a huge difference. Also, the headphone mixes, you know, just going in and being able to feel comfortable in the playbacks and hearing everyone, you know, in a way that makes it very communicative and you can relate to everyone on a creative level. It can never be underestimated, the setup, you know.
Well, I guess we should hear that. We're going to play a couple of tracks.
Okay, great.
What's the first track?
Well, the first track I think we're going to hear is I Confess, which is the single, worldwide single.
Let's play it.
I confess I'll be your daddy. Ask for anything, I'll do it gladly. Life without you only brought me heartache. I've had all the lonely I can take. Now I know the letting go was my mistake.
That's the single. Is it still, is it not that it shouldn't be, but is it still strange after 30 years kind of going, well, that's going to be the single, that's going to be the one on the radio, that's the one I'm kind of talking about to you today? Does that ever get a bit, do you ever get down in the mouth about having to do that, or do you still kind of just love, do you love hearing it back?
No, what you mean listening back or saying it's a single?
Listening to it back.
Oh, no, it's just a little embarrassing to have you, like, look at me and...
I wasn't doing air guitar or anything. I mean, I wasn't air singing, I was...
I would have loved that.
Sitting
though.
Back in my chair. and as you said, this is sort of a return to country, and I guess that's...
Yeah.
Is that a sort of good example of the rest of the record for people that haven't heard it?
Well, no, not that, because the band hasn't kicked in yet. But it's country, but it's not. I mean, I never did country purely. It was always some sort of hybrid, and this is also a hybrid. I would think it's kind of Americana or alt country or country rock or something. I'm not really sure what it is, because a lot of people say this isn't a country record, and then a lot of people say this is a country record. So I just kind of roll with whatever the presenter wants to call it.
And what, as a musician, a singer, what do you think about those labels? It seems to be alt country, country rock, psych folk.
Yeah.
There's also Folktronica.
Folktronica.
There's all sorts of places we could go.
Yeah.
These terms that musicians use with each other, are they only journalists that bandy these terms around, do you think?
Well, you know, I actually think that musicians use it when they're talking to other musicians, because you need some sort of guidance when you're communicating any sort of creative thing. You need, like, a color palette or a taste palette or whatever. But, you know, I just think when the media calls me something, I react to it, and I always try to go to the farthest end of what it is and to the opposing point. But I guess ultimately it doesn't really matter. I think in the long run, as long as I'm known as a vocalist and that I've tried to maintain a sense of integrity in my art, then whatever you call me is fine.
We're going to play in some whooping and cheering after that comment, I think. and we're going to introduce the next track, introduce the next track as well. What's the next track we're going to play?
The next track is Water's Edge. Yeah, Water's Edge.
That's a perfect introduction.
With an angel by my side, I was sure I'd die and gone to heaven.
Mellifluous. Is it as mellifluous as it sounds? Some beautiful lyrics in there. Mellifluous.
Yeah.
I think it means sort of emollient and smooth moving.
Yeah.
We're going to have people emailing in. This isn't a phone-in show or something.
I've never heard that.
Mellifluous.
That word. No, never heard that.
Come on. We've got to incorporate that now.
It's a British thing, I think.
Mellifluous,
yeah.
Is it? That sounded slow and Mississippi-ish, that one.
Yeah.
Water's Edge, what's that about? You know,
getting shagged by the river, I think.
Okay, perfect. That's that should be the B-side. You should have to turn it over.
Getting shagged by the river.
Be the perfect name for a B-side. well, I don't think we can. I don't think we can do any better than that as a definition of the record. That's now no journalist need to pass judgment on it. It can always be the being shagged by a river record.
Well, it's definitely a shagged by the river record.
Okay, perfect.
With a little tequila.
Yeah.
You know, after shot.
Okay, that's good.
Post shag shot.
It's good for getting rid of rush burns. Yeah. Tequila.
Is it?
Yeah,
You pour it on the wound, or you drink it?
You drink it and you rub some on. It's it's good. Like all alcohol, it's a good antiseptic.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Because this can be tough by the river.
Maybe I should actually package this album with a bottle of tequila.
Maybe you should. Well, you've got your next video sorted.
Yeah.
Well,
that's pouring tequila on various parts of the body.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming in
and talking to us.
Sing It Loud was out on Monday, the 18th of April. And when are you touring and where?
We are touring at the end of May. If I were really a professional, I would have the dates in front of me.
We can put those up on our website.
That would
be
great.
Yeah. Katie Lang, thank you very much for coming in and meeting us.
Thank you for your time,
sir. Thank
you.
That was our Rob Bound talking to Canadian Katie Lang. How do you feel about Katie Lang, Andrew?
I know you wanted to emphasize the Canadian bit there.
Well, I had to. You grew up doing that because just when I was in Canada last week, it's extraordinary that, and it was funny because someone else made this observation that, I mean, they slap a maple leaf on absolutely anything. And you remind me when you go into the bookstores that, you know, they've got sort of the current bestsellers, and then you get five sections of Canadian authors, and then it's Canadian music. And, you know, that there is that, you know, like in Sweden and many other places, France, I mean, you do have a quota on Canadian content.
And it's interesting, you know, Canada's obviously a big country, but still when you say to Canadian, oh, who's from Canada? They always have a list ready of like.
Should I start?
Yeah, you can start, can't you?
Yeah, Avril Lavigne.
Okay, and
you're starting with Avril Lavigne.
Well, why not? No, because I just saw Avril Lavigne's new not very good video the other day when I was watching MTV. You don't hear about MTV much anymore. You hear more about Canada.
Successful women singers. That's a kind of Canadian.
It's our biggest export. Celine Dion, Shania Twain, Alanis. Drove by her high school the other day. We didn't go to the same high school, but. Yeah, I drove by Alanis' high school.
Do they have a picture of her outside?
They might do, yeah.
With a maple leaf on. Exactly. In a strategic place.
Anyway, but you like Kitty.
I love Kitty. And in fact, when those first albums came out many years ago, well, God, it must have been 20 years ago. That was kind of constant craving on my...
constant craving.
Yeah.
And I like Miss Chatelaine, which is also a Canadian women's magazine. Yeah.
And she did an amazing rendition of that song, Three Cigarettes in the Ashtray, which is very nice as well.
Okay, do you want to sing it for us?
No.
No, okay. Then we'll go for a break. You're listening to The Monocle Week. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly. This week sees the release of a new book predicting the biggest scientific breakthroughs we're set to see over the next 100 years. Based on 300 interviews with the world's top scientists, Physics of the Future presents what revolutions will be made in the fields of medicine, computers, quantum physics, stay with me, Andrew, and space travel. The author, Dr. Michio Kaku, joins us on the line now from New York to tell us more. Hello, Dr. Kaku.
Hi, glad to be on the show.
Thank you. I'm looking at your picture in the inside back cover, and while a very handsome picture, you look quite startled. And I'm wondering, when you look across the next 100 years, are there some sort of quite frightening findings for humankind?
Well, I've had a chance to interview the world's top scientists who are inventing the future in their laboratory. And they tell me that when you first hear some of the incredible predictions they're making and the prototypes they are building, the first reaction might be a little bit of fear because you think, oh my God, I'm going to be left behind. I'm too old to learn this stuff. But then you enter stage two, and in stage two, you begin to realize, hey, I could use this technology. I mean, this stuff is really good. And then stage three is, ha, I knew it all along. In fact, it's old hat. I invented it. I anticipated it. And so all of us go through three stages encountering these new technologies. Let's take a look, for example, at internet contact lenses. In the future, you will simply blink and you will go online. You will see people's faces and your glasses will identify who they are and print out their biography next to their image. And if they're speaking Chinese to you, your contact lenses or your glasses will translate what they say and put subtitles right beneath them. So at first you may say to yourself, wow, can I learn this stuff? I mean, this is pretty advanced. But then you begin to realize that this is very useful. If you're looking for a job and you don't know who the important people are at a cocktail party, in the future, you'll know exactly who to suck up to at any cocktail party. And
artists are usually afraid of technologies, but they're going to say, now, wait a minute. I can just wave my hands in the air and create beautiful masterpieces of artwork just by moving my fingers in the air. And architects will say to themselves, hey, this is useful. Instead of having to redesign my building when I move a tower or move an apartment, I can simply wave my hands, and the model of my beautiful masterpiece skyscraper will move as I move my fingers. Now, tourists will say, hey, this is useful. If I'm walking the streets of Rome, there's nothing left of the Roman Empire anymore. But in the future, I'll simply push a button and I'll see the entire Roman Empire resurrected in my contact lens as I walk through the ruins of the Roman Empire. So people are beginning to realize this could be very useful. And of course, college kids, they're going to be the first ones to buy these internet contact lenses because they're going to be taking final examinations. And they will blink and see all the answers in their contact lens.
Now, I want to know, will I be able to get these contact lenses by Christmas time? Or is it going to be 50 years out? Or is it somewhere in between? Or is it just, at the clock of 100 years from now?
About 10 to 15 years. Already scientists at the University of Washington in Seattle are building prototypes. And the United States military is taking this very seriously. I flew down to Fort Benning, Georgia with the Discovery Channel with a film crew and actually filmed the military's version of this. When you put on your helmet, there's a little eyepiece stuck to the helmet. You flick it down and immediately you see the entire internet of the battlefield, friendly forces, enemy forces, airplanes, tanks laid out, which will eliminate the fog of war. And so the military is spending millions of dollars perfecting this. So you'll have basically an instantaneous view of the battlefield simply by blinking.
Now, I'm going to just ask a question. Maybe it's the typical sort of old fart question. But when you talk about, let's say, the cocktail party of the future, and you would be able to immediately clock who the most interesting people are in the room and how useful that would be for your CV. Where we sit today, it's sort of a question of just sort of pace of change. I mean, I'm always surprised how many people, leave various things up on their Facebook profile and that they haven't even come to terms with that yet. And we've been living with, these elements of social media for a long time. But yet, you aim to potentially hire someone for a job and then they've got some very inappropriate profile pictures sitting on a toilet, in an absolute sort of drunken mess. And you think, okay, well, they might be good at the job, but they don't perhaps have sort of, the best judge of how to deal with their own personal PR. So when you talk about these changes, Dr. Kaku, do you think that certainly the speed of change is going to be one of the major learning curves. But that aside, and not just talking about pace, but also just the radical shift and perhaps just how transparent society becomes. And I think that's certainly one of the big issues right now is privacy. How much do I reveal? And everyone says, well, of course, you can turn all these things off. But there comes a point everyone else is doing it, so I have to as well.
Well, we're still very young in the internet age, and so young people they go overboard. They put naked pictures of themselves on the internet,
and then just young ones.
Those pictures haunt them years later when they apply for a job. So the simple social protocols have yet to be firmly established with this. However, it's coming very rapidly, and young people are some of the first to gravitate toward this and realize that even in the Middle East, we're seeing the implications of the fact that most people are under the age of 30 in the Middle East. They're all wired up, and they're basically overthrowing governments now in the Middle East as a consequence of Twitter and Facebook. And just realize that throughout history, no two democracies have ever warred with each other. Think of every single war you've had to memorize since you were in grade school. And you realize they've always been between dictatorships and monarchies and things like that, never between two democracies. And the internet is a democratizing force. And so, yeah, there's a lot of infantilism out there, people putting wrong things on their Facebook page. But think of the larger geopolitical implications of this, where governments are being toppled because young people realize they don't have to live in ignorance and poverty. They don't have to live like that. They can simply blink and see what's happening in other countries with other peoples who are free. And I think that's going to reduce the fires that generate war because democracies don't war with other democracies.
But as we've just seen in one of our earlier guests, we were chatting to someone, you know, in Beirut, talking about the situation in Syria. It also takes something as simple as just turning off the power to suddenly disenable all of these people. And I'm wondering, will we be able to overcome, you know, simple issues of battery power? We only have to go to see what happened in, you know, in Japan as well. You know, if you don't have AA batteries, you can have all the new technology in the world, but it doesn't get you very far.
Well, in the future, we'll simply use the energy from our own bodies to energize these things. Your bicycle has a little magnet which spins because it's connected to the wheel. That magnet, because of Faraday's effect, pushes electrons and creates electricity for you in your bicycle without a battery. These devices I'm talking about consume very little amounts of energy. In fact, you don't want your contact lens to absorb too much energy because it'll heat up. It'll heat up the surface of your eye. And so we're going to have devices that use energy from the motions of your body without having batteries at all.
Dr. Kaku, hi. This is Steve in the studio. Forgive my skepticism, but weren't we supposed to have jetpacks by now?
Realize that it was science fiction writers and historians and sociologists that made a lot of predictions in the 50s, not physicists. Show me one physicist who actually said we're going to have jetpacks and flying cars. Now, first of all, we already have jetpacks. The Nazis, in fact, perfected the jetpack during World War II with hydrogen peroxide and used them to shoot soldiers right across rivers where the bridges were knocked out by the Allies. However, these hydrogen peroxide jetpacks only last for just a few minutes, like 2 minutes, 3 minutes, enough to shoot a Nazi soldier across the river, but totally impractical to commute to work. Also, flying cars, they already exist. In fact, I took a film crew from the Discovery Channel and filmed a flying car. But its fuel mileage is miserable, absolutely miserable. And so we're going to have to wait until we have nanobatteries that have tremendous power that can last for hours, not just 2 minutes. And also magnetic cars to have flying cars. Don't believe the prediction of science fiction writers. Believe the prediction of physicists. Unfortunately, physicists don't have access to the media. They cannot get on BBC television and have a press conference. That's why I wrote the book. Every single prototype in the book is backed by a physicist or a doctor or a chemist. We're talking real prototypes, not science fiction.
Dr. Kaku, is Andrew here. One question about the kind of the social impact of this. You know, we all have our BlackBerries, which we love, and our mobile phones, which we use every day. But all of us have to acknowledge as well that it slightly alienates us from people around us. It kind of shuts us off. They become our masters rather than us kind of controlling, you know, the communication that comes into us. Do you think in the future that people will become increasingly isolated and individualistic and disconnected from the people around them, and perhaps a little bit less happy with all this new technology?
Well, first of all, technology will not make us happier. We are genetically programmed to be slightly unhappy because our ancestors were slightly timid, slightly unhappy apes, and that guaranteed their survival. So we are genetically hardwired to be slightly unhappy, and technology is not going to change that. However, take a look at when the telephone was first introduced in the last century. There were many editorials denouncing the telephone. They said, we're no longer going to talk to our people, our relatives at dinner time. We're going to spend our time talking to this disembodied voice from the ether. And the critics were absolutely right. We do spend less time talking to our family members at dinner time. We do spend an inordinate amount of time talking to disembodied voices in the ether. And you know something? We love it. We absolutely love it. Because the range of our friends and acquaintances expanded by a factor of 100 with the telephone. And now with the internet, our range of acquaintances has expanded by 1 million. You realize that kids today, when they play video games, they think nothing of competing against other kids in Russia, other kids in Iceland, other kids in Australia. To them, boundaries don't mean anything for young kids. And I think that's a good thing, because it means that the boundaries between nations are gradually going to dissolve. And I think that's a good thing, because it means that dictatorships are going to have much harder time revving up the fears of the enemy to create wars when the people say, now, wait a minute, some of my best friends happen to be in the country that we're going to go to war with.
And so I think this is going to reduce the fires of war. However, there are people who may become shut-ins, some people who are going to spend too much time playing video games and stuff like that. Yes, there is a downside to that, but I think in the main, that's balanced by the fact that our circle of friends has increased by a factor of a million. And I think that's a good thing.
Dr. Kaku, just before we go, and you know, for the moment, we don't live in a completely borderless world. And as you're just talking about people being able to sort of, you know, play games with people in other nations, I'm also wondering, when you interviewed these 300 physicists around the world, were there any clusters that stood out? You know, did one area or several areas stand out to you when you were doing your research?
Well, one area that stood out rapidly is the change, the pace of change in medicine. For example, we can grow most simple organs of the body now from your own cells, and we're now teasing apart the genes that control the aging process. This is huge. Who would have thought that we'd be able to look at the molecular genetic level as to precisely why we get old and why we die, why organs fail? And this is going to affect the way we view cancer and all sorts of diseases. For example, the cure for cancer could be your toilet. Your toilet will have DNA chips in them that scan for proteins emitted maybe from 100 cancer cells in a cancer colony 10 years before a tumor forms. The word tumor could disappear from the English language. So there are absolutely staggering advances being made in medicine, complements of the computer age, complements of DNA sequencing, which are going to change the way we view our organs, change the way we view our lifespan, and change the way we view cancer. And that's been a real eye-opener.
Great. Dr. Michio Kaku, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Thank you. That was Dr. Michio Kaku. The book is Physics of the Future. It's by Penguin under the Alan Lane imprint. Andrew, are you going to buy some of those special contact lenses?
Yeah, if it helps me kind of get the TV to work, because I can't even do that sometimes. I can't even get the telly to come on. What will I be like with those contact lenses? It will be impossible.
Do you think he rode down to Fort Benning in a spaceship?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just so much kind of stuff that you just know actually people will either be reluctant to adopt or you'll buy the wrong system or you've got the contact lenses that actually they don't make after 5 years.
It's just so hard to predict. I mean, I think a lot of these things, there may well be prototypes, but there's a world of difference between having a prototype and having anything that's actually people are going to think, yeah, this is worth investing in and it will become mainstream.
Yeah. I think we should stick to big microphones and big headphones for now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly here in Spaceship London, where it's time for this week's monologue with Steve Bloomfield. Do you want to read it live, or should we have the pre-recorded version?
Let's have the pre-record.
Okay.
Everyone loves a good wedding. The cake, the dress, the ridiculous drunken dancing. But once the big day is over, once the honeymoon is a distant memory, there is always a danger that the relationship goes a bit, well, stale. And things can get even worse if it is a marriage of convenience. One London couple, almost 1 year into their unexpected union, know exactly how that feels. As William and Kate begin their first days of married life, David Cameron and Nick Clegg can only look back on their big day and wonder where it all went wrong. The UK's coalition government, a civil partnership between Conservative Party leader Cameron and his Liberal Democrat counterpart Clegg, has been stuttering of late. Arguments over policy have been amplified by the stress of an unexpectedly bitter referendum over voting reform, which has seen Messrs Cameron and Clegg campaign on opposing sides. But here are 10 ways that we believe they can get their relationship back on track. Number 1. Spend some quality time together. In the early days, they assembled IKEA furniture and played tennis. Now Nick is telling journalists the pair are not mates. Come on, Nick. How about a ride on a tandem? Number 2. Both sides have to give a little. Look, Dave, Nick was willing to drop his principal to higher university tuition fees. Why can't you be nice and change your plans to get rid of the family doctor? Number 3. Don't slag off the in-laws. Nick, did you really need to remind Dave he's part of a right-wing clique? Number 4. Don't talk about former lovers. So perhaps, Nick, you should tell your fellow Lib Dems to stop making eyes at the Labour Party. Number 5. It helps if your friends are supportive. Dave, you really should tell your pals to stop slagging off Nick, reminding people of his broken promises. And Nick, it doesn't help when your friends compare Dave's mates to Nazis. Number 6. Opposites attract, and there's nothing wrong with that. Nick, you knew Dave got a little white van man when he talked about immigration. And Dave, you knew Nick had a thing about social mobility. Neither of you should rise to it. Number 7. Don't row about family finances. On this at least, Nick and Dave appear to still agree, even if Nick had claimed before the marriage that the kids' pocket money perhaps shouldn't be squeezed by that much. Number 8. There is only so much space in a double bed. In the first tender months, Nick and Dave were happy to snuggle together in the middle. But as the love has waned, Dave now tends to sleep more on the right, while Nick is happier on the left. Wouldn't you feel better if you hugged in the middle again? Number 9. Remember you have a common enemy. Yes, the Labour Party. Slag them off. You'll feel better. And if that doesn't work, have a go at the Lib Dem left and the Tory right as well. Number 10. If it all goes wrong, don't panic. Lots of relationships end up in divorce these days. Dave will probably be fine on his own. His lot normally are. As for Nick, there's always that nice boy Ed Miliband. If he'll still have you.
And that was our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. In very tight briefs, don't you think? At least it sounded like before we went out to...
Is that the pre-record?
Yeah, let's have your... I hope you've got your boxers on now.
I do, yes.
Oh, Andrew.
I know. What can we do with the young'uns, eh?
I know. Do you want to come to the show next week again?
Oh, can I?
I know. Is Rob going to be back next week?
Yeah, he's coming back.
He was heading down to Rio, or was he? I don't know. I think we were going to send him to New Orleans.
He was going to go to Rio, then he decided to go to Seoul.
Yes.
And then, so no Rio. Because it's too complicated going from Incheon to Rio.
I think it is. There's a stop in Los Angeles on Korean Air, and then we have to get to Sao Paulo, and then you have to get another plane. Yes. Quite complicated.
So I told him not to go. Come back to the office. It's nicer.
Are you heading anywhere nice soon?
I'm not quite sure yet. We haven't worked it out.
Andrew hasn't taught you any table scraps?
Not yet. We'll discuss that.
I gave him Ankara. What more does he want?
No. Andrew, we need to get you on the road soon.
I'm going to Washington.
Yes, I know that. You're going to talk to Mr.
Yeah, but then I need some nicer things. Well, I was meant to be going to Ankara.
I need some nicer things.
I was going to Ankara, exactly. And then I had to give it to Steve because it was...
You sound so crushed.
Well,
he did. He was actually very crushed. Until I brought back some Turkish delight, which made him happy.
Actually, I looked at the weather report. I thought it was going to be nice and nice. I thought Steve can go.
I've got some meetings.
Can you catch the flight at 6 a.m.?
Oh, God, it was. And coming back, it was... Sorry, just moan for one moment.
Yeah.
It was a 6:15 flight from Ankara to Munich, which meant I had to be at the airport at 4:15.
Was that on Pegasus Air?
It was... it was Lufthansa.
Right,
okay. It was Ankara to Munich, Munich to Heathrow, and then back in the office at my desk by 11 a.m.
You little Turkish trooper.
Yeah.
That's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills here in London. Our sound engineer was Chris Sharp here at the Sound Company, also in London. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember to catch up with us daily via our monocolumn on our site. Next week, we're in London, but for now, from London, I'm Tyler Brulé. How many times can I say London, do you think, at the end? I think I've got it 4 or 5 times. Who are
well
you?
Done. I'm London. No, I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Steve Bloomfield.
More next week. Goodbye.